Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well,
I'd. Hello, everyone. Big Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tim L. We got Andrew on the board today after SP Futures up 14, NASDAQ Futures up 58. We have Professor Kevin. We're a little late here.
Morning.
Morning. How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right.
You know, once in a while when you make an executive decision and you say, gee, that wasn't so hot this morning, we get into Kennedy, which is now kind of a cluster bleep because of this. They're back into construction mode, incompetent as they are. I don't understand why all of a sudden they've gotten so incompetent. But so it's jam coming in, which I'm thinking is kind of odd. Why should it be jam coming in? So we don't get off at the early exit. I figure it's just jam. And all of a sudden they come on the radio and say there's a five-car pileup in the middle of downtown. I'm like, oops. So I guess I could have got off earlier, but I did not. But it was an executive decision.
No, it's just, you know, there have been lots of times, when I have found myself knowing, you know, like I know when the report comes on and when they get a minute behind, I'm going, come on, I got to make a decision here.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of messed up, but we got stuff going on today. We've got the Fed announcement. Nobody's expecting them to change anything, but obviously everybody listening to what the dude says and hanging on every word, and while he continues to feed us our list of whatever the hell they feed us. So there you go. The Harvard is now tuition free for undergraduates under 200,000. Well, we spotted this, Kevin.
That a long time ago.
Well, okay. It says, obviously, maybe you should call up Jessica Dickler is her name. Harvard University is now the latest institution to become tuition-free for undergraduates with family incomes below $200,000.
Right.
There you go.
Good for them. You got a big endowment like that, you can afford to do stuff like that.
I never really had that much of an inclination to want to go to Harvard, did you? Not that they would have wanted me, but
my mind. But if I had put in an application, it probably wouldn't have crossed their mind either. So,
well, one of the guys who graduated at Marist, I don't know if he graduated number one, but he was up there. If he wasn't number one, I think Jim Pfister was number one. Remember him? Played softball with us.
Sure.
I think this guy might have been number two, or the other way around, one of the two. And he went to Harvard. Ended up becoming a lawyer. They get a nice career. Nice guy.
Yeah, good guy.
So, I thought this guy's name is John McCambridge. He went to Harvard. And he was normal. He wasn't like the other two people. Well, I didn't know the Unabomber, thank God, but I knew the guy across the street that came home from Harvard and blew his parents away with a shotgun. That wasn't so hot, Kevin. Just saying.
Well, I think we all have our embarrassing alumni, so.
Yeah, well, then there was the Unabomber. He grew up about a mile from me. I went to Evergreen Park High School, where I did a lot of summer classes, as in, like, typing and that sort of stuff. Evergreen Park High School is nice. Matter of fact, boy, we used to play our Pee Wee League games there, and now you can't have that anymore because it's softball field, super nice baseball field. All of a sudden, they got lots of scratch-o from somewhere. They used to always talk about it, the war between the generations, Kevin. Evergreen Park was always a lot of older families, people have a lot of kids and stuff, but whenever they went for the big vote for all kinds of scratch for the high school, for some massive athletic field improvement or something, it always got voted down because there were more people maybe that didn't have kids that did. Now, democracy can be an odd thing, huh? It can be, you can have tyranny of the majority as much as you can have tyranny of the minority, right?
Yep.
So in other places, you know, no matter what the schools want, they always got it. And people were always pissed off because, you know, the place looks like a small college and the kids really need that. When none of them had it, you know, that type of thing. And so obviously maybe the population has changed a little in Park, and now they're just building. It's nice. Anyway,
yeah, but you know, split it in two or something. You know, my daughter went to Stevenson up in Lincolnshire. Now I remember Stevenson, you know, when it was a few hundred people, and you know, it was just kind of an outpost out there. But everything grew. Well, they have, you know, like 4,600 students there, and it's like you just described. It's a small, you know, it's not even that small as a college campus, but it's a, you know, it's a small college campus. And I think it's just, you know, when you talk about what you want to get out of high school, it's a good way for a lot of kids to get lost, you know, kind of lost in the large numbers. It means you're going to have a lot of large classes, which are not necessarily conducive to the most conducive to learning. It, you know, there's just a lot that goes with it. And it was a good school, and there were a lot of, you know, go to conferences, parent-teacher conferences, things like that, go to the events at the school. There was a lot to be said positive about it, so I'm not running down the school, but I just don't like that kind of size to a school.
Well, do you remember, what the hell is the guy's name, Kevin? He ended up going to jail, the guy who ran, like, Lincoln Way West and East, and but these are South Side high schools, and there's a bike trail down there that I used to use when my stepfather was in the home down in, what the hell's the name of the place? Mantino. I would hop off and I'd do my 19 miles on the bike before I'd... Anyway, the bike takes you through, really, it goes all the way from Olympia Fields to Joliet, the trail, 19 miles. Absolutely terrific bike trail, the old plank trail. But the first time on it, I'm going by this place and I go, what in the hell is that? It was one of the Lincoln Ways. They had more, well, I won't say now because the place is built like there's no tomorrow, but the athletic fields look like we were at Notre Dame, for God's sake. Then I passed, what's the name of the Catholic school down there, Kevin? I'm sure you played those guys. What the hell's the name of it? My buddy's on the board. I go by the Catholic school, and there's a, you know, kind of a modest football field, a modest baseball field, nice, and then a track, and, you know, like more than you would ever think you'd have in high school. And then it's Lincoln Way, I'm going, who did? And there, I think there were three of them. This guy just kept building. Finally, they reeled him in because he was getting kickbacks from the contractors. I think he went to jail and probably paid all his money back, and they closed one of them. How do you close a school that costs that much money, for God's sake?
No. But, you know, just, sunk costs are, fill in the blank.
Yeah, it's sunk.
Yes. So they're no longer part of any decision-making process. Once the money's gone, it's gone.
Well, you'd think they could have sold it to, like, you know, some college, because it was like as big. Anyway, about
that would have been a good idea, and you could make, you know, you could make it you know, like a branch, you know, classroom for convenience of the students or for them to reach into that particular geographic location. So yeah, there are options, but on the other hand, I do get that sometimes, you know, you can't. You have to shut down the corruption. Speaking of which,
yeah,
I want to follow up on your conversation with Hal yesterday a little bit, because when you were talking about, you know, how you can coordinate some of these cuts with Congress, how do you think that should work? Because I want to hear from you. I have some ideas too. So
the only thing I know about, Kevin, is what I've read about the how Clinton and Gore did it. And somehow, and I think Newt was part of it. Newt Gingrich. Somehow or another, they were kind of all on the same page, and whatever, they didn't, well, I think that what's going on now is a little bit, we're throwing out programs we don't like, which is not, I don't think those guys, well, who knows, it was so long ago.
Let's describe, yeah, what is that, programs we don't like?
Well, I'm saying, I think they went in for just too many people in duplication, I think is what they didn't necessarily go into, Now, maybe there weren't as many back then. I don't know. They didn't actually go into, you know, a department and say, well, we don't like this part of what you're doing. We don't like that part of what we're doing. I don't think. There was more of a, look, there's a duplication in this place. We got, you know, X number of, I think some of it was in the Army where they got rid of some, you know, they did some of the duplications and, like, you know, spy stuff and everything else. But they essentially did that, and they, Congress was sort of with them. Every time they pulled a function or people out of a department, evidently, Congress sort of reflected that in the next spending bill. And it was, I don't know how they were in it together, but somehow they were. And they ended up having some sort of a training stuff for guys who were fired and that kind of thing. And it really wasn't even that big of a, the government unions were involved. Where some of the training programs were put through the unions and things like that. It wasn't a 2-week program. It was like an 8-year program to lower things down. It was just a different, you know, it was a way of doing it, which is kind of more my style. But that's, you know, style points don't get you anywhere. I know that. But it, that's what I think they did. And, but 300,000 people over 8 years is a lot. I mean, for God's sake! I mean, I don't think.
Yeah, I remember, you know, Clinton doing that big speech. The days of big government are over. So
I think a lot of it was just that they didn't hire a lot of people. You know, there's in any place like that. I mean, you know this better than me because you've been involved. There's pretty good attrition. When people retiring and stuff all the time, they might have gotten to a spot where a lot of people just happen to be retirement. I don't think they can 300,000 people. I mean, I don't think they did at all. I mean, there just were 300,000 people less when they left. What would you guess? They maybe got rid of half of that, if that. Just maybe stopped hiring and it just let people. I mean, if you have a 3 million person workforce over, say, you work for 40 years, what does that get you? 10, 20,000 people quitting a year just on natural stuff? I don't know how much you even have to do when you're that big, right?
Well, it sort of depends on the. It depends on the economic times, but yeah, there's, you know, it's always something you want to control the rate of turnover, but because it's expensive.
We also can't go a situation. I mean, you teach this kind of stuff more than me. You also don't want a year, or two, or three where you don't hire anybody, and you got that kind of hole in your age group either, do you?
No, I don't think it changes that quickly. So I wouldn't get into that as much. If you were to plot productivity over time, you know, how productive are you the first day you start a job?
Well, I suppose it depends. If you come out of electrician school, hopefully you can do something your first day. If you don't, yeah. If you go off the street, then you do nothing, right?
But how you know, relatively speaking, how productive are you? Your first day on the job versus your 30th day on the job versus your 300th day on the job, and so on.
Well, you would hope you would get more productive over time. I'm thinking...
Until you hit whatever the peak is for the job.
Well, when I got to Pullman my first day, before you had a computer on your desk, and I had a phone there, of course nobody knew the number, and I didn't know anybody to call, so I was involved in the contract for the push-pull commuter cars for Boston, so they gave me the contract to read for a day or two, which took a day or two. And then I met all the people on the team, and you're right, I didn't do much for a while. Just saying.
Yeah, so, but the point is this. As you go up that productivity curve, every time you somebody that's, you know, experienced leaves, they get replaced with somebody on the lower end of the productivity curve. And that person can then build back up. But when you have too much churn, when you have a lot of turnover, that means you have a lot of more productive people being replaced by less productive people. And so your rate of turnover, the economic side of it, isn't just onboarding people and recruiting and all of those things that you have to do and paying people overtime when you're short staffed. It isn't just that. It is also this idea that you're going to, the fewer people you have on the lower end of the productivity curve, the better off you are from a cost standpoint. And that's you know, so that's what's important. That's why I say if somebody went 3 years without having any turnover, they'd probably be happy as could be. Because that means, you know, assuming you have a good cohesive group of people, not you don't have a bunch of slackers or something, that, you know, that you have a team. It's an experienced team, people working together, and people very high on the curve. I think that tells you something.
Well, some firms used to be, you know, some more than others. Firms used to think they have a 100-year time horizon, right? I mean, at Pullman, there were three generations of people working there when I was there, and some firms don't. I mean, for whatever reason, I don't think that a lot of the people. I mean, I talk about it a lot, Kevin. A lot of it's the attitude. I mean, some of the work that's coming back from overseas. I don't know if it's coming back or whatever it is. It's whatever. We seem to have some expansion in metalworking, at least in this area. Well, it's expanding from, I'm going to say, the 1975 was probably maybe the war was the highest, but on a scale of 1 to 10, that might have been a 9. You know, we're down to a 2, working its way back to a 3. I still don't know if the people here, I'm guessing they don't feel that their kids and grandkids are going to be running that firm. You know, the direction's been one way for so long. That's why I think this is very difficult to kind of turn this bus around. But ideally, there were people who didn't want exactly what you said. They didn't want all the people are retiring in 1 year with, you know, with 80% of your embedded knowledge. Not 80%, but say 50%. So they really wanted, you know, 10 people hired a year.
Yeah, well, so they want something. Succession planning is important. So that, you know, that's part of the equation as well. And you have to have some amount of succession no matter what age group you have, because, you know, somebody might get hit by a bus, get seriously ill. There's all kinds of reasons. So it is important to have a good talent pipeline, and I agree with that, but you want to minimize turnover as much as you can. It's as a cost for the cost, your employment, your salary expense, your employment, and really more for productivity than anything else. Plus, if you do any kind of continuous improvement model where you're squeezing cost out of your system using lean techniques, then you're also, you know, that requires experienced people who understand the process and are able to adapt to changes in the process, and in fact are going to bring you good ideas. Okay, so that's the management class side of it.
By the way, there is a company that somehow for a long time has done kind of just the opposite, Kevin. And that's UPS. They bring people in, they don't pay them a whole hell of a lot, work them like dogs. Their turnover is dramatic, and they don't care. They're happy with it. They're okay with it.
Well, and people would argue that Amazon distribution centers are the same way.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And it's not how I would run a company. And I know in UPS's case, they actually had people limited to four hour shifts because the work was so hard. You know, packing trucks and sorting packages and so on. So they limited people to 4 hour shifts, and that goes back as long as I can remember. So I don't know that a lot of that had to do with benefits, you know, back in the day or anything like that. It may very much have to do with that. You know, at some point becomes part of their cost structure. But again, you know, if you're paying if you're going part time because you don't want to pay benefits. You know, you could figure that to be 20-25% of the on top of the salary.
Yeah.
If you look at if you find yourself at a poor spot on the macro level on the productivity curve, that's costing you at least 25%. So you know, I don't think it's a good economic model.
Kevin, don't some states? I thought Illinois. I know we talked about it. Illinois just passed something or other that you can't weasel out of all the benefits for every day work. Don't you get like an hour towards vacation or something? You can't just say you get nothing, right?
I don't know Illinois law on that, so I'll take your word for it.
But I mean, it either was proposed, we talked about it one day, it was either proposed or passed, I can't remember, but it can't be where somebody who's working, you know, 38 hours a week, like, never gets a vacation or something like that. There's got to be some sort of a, I mean, I'm only saying there's got to be one. I mean, I think there's been laws about in the various states that say you can't be a stone cold zero where nobody gets a sick day or nobody gets a vacation day, even if they're working 38 instead of 40, or some
it,
states
it
have been.
It would be stupid business anyway, so,
yeah.
So one way or another it's going to happen. So let's go back to it. Can the executive branch shut down a department that was created by Congress?
I've been asking everybody that, and depending on what side of the political spectrum we're on, I get a different answer, but I haven't heard the legal answer yet.
Well, there's a judge that says no, but that I'm sure is going to get appealed. But my thought process on that is no, I don't think you can. I don't think you can turn off USAID. I don't think you can turn off the Department of Education, per se. Now, what can you do? Let's take USAID as an example. You can say, we're going to stop spending money on stupid stuff, and we're going to stop spending money on fraudulent stuff. And by stupid stuff, I mean, we're going to stop funding, trans education in some third world company. We're going to stop funding, story hour, the drag queen story hours. And
well, that's one man's, what was Fred Sanford, one man's treasure is another man's junk. I mean, you and I would both agree that if we're doing something about sex life of fish in Africa, it's probably stupid stuff, right? Fish, not people. But I guess what I don't know the question is if you just give a chunk of money to somebody, a department, and they wander off and do this stuff, and there's no real definition of what the hell it is they're supposed to be doing, I think you got a massive agreeer on your side of this would be me.
Yeah, but, and that's how it works, Tom. Legislation.
I'm not sure, Kevin, because all the stuff, there is no. There's a hookup here, and that's what I can't find. I mean, even in, I use one I'm very familiar with, insider trading, front running. There's never really been a congressional bill that defines that. Yet. Everybody will tell you there's all this case law, and everything the SEC does becomes almost like law or something. I mean, what do you mean? What do you mean almost like law? Over 50, 60 years, there's such a history of it that somehow or another people would think that this is really law. But I guess use the one about, was it Radio Free America or whatever that got raided last week, raided for lack of a better term. I have to believe that Congress knows for 75 years after World War II that we've been doing radio across the world. It used to be Radio Free America, whatever they used to call it back. I remember this when the Berlin Wall was still up. That we've been doing that for 75 years. Now, I don't know how specific it is in the bill. I don't know, in the committee when they fund it. I have no idea what committee it comes out of, but it comes out of some place, gets passed, and then some president signed it. Now, if somebody comes in and says, hey, look, Radio Free America is funding God knows what else that we don't know how the hell you got the money for that. I guess I'm okay with what are you doing that for? But to go in and say, we don't do no Radio Free America anymore, when the guy just signed the bill last week, I have a problem with that. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I honestly don't.
The question is, when was the bill signed?
Well, it was signed 4 days ago.
Was it auto-funded all along? There's a lot of questions there. But when you say... But you certainly get to go and say we're going to stop doing dumb stuff, and Radio Free America or Voice of America or whatever, Radio Free Europe, it might not make any sense anymore as a medium. So that's worth evaluation on the phone. But what I'm getting at is there's also a lot of trail now that's being explored because we finally have data analysts looking into this, where we see money that goes from one organization to another organization to another organization that somehow finds its way back into the family of a politician, and that has to that kind of stuff is, as far as I'm concerned, is just fraud.
It's not new, but it's fraud.
It's not new, but it's fraud, and so it's just easier to discover now if you use you know, if you use modern day data analytics,
Kevin, you and I could always have found it.
How many times have you seen, you know, a subpoena compliance when Congress subpoenas something and they give them the documents and it takes them, you know, 6 months to do it because they have to go through and manually redact everything. You don't need to do that. They print them, then they read them, they line them out, then they scan them back in and turn them over. That's, you know, that is 40-year-old technology.
We have all kinds of issues here, Kevin, and we're just opening them up. I mean, when what's his name, Phil Graham, whose wife was the governance person at Enron, Wendy Graham, and got him to ram through a bill that stuff was not regulated, and look what happened. Look how many people got nailed on that. Then there's the question of, can you regulate somebody's wife or somebody's husband? I think you have a real problem with that anywhere in society. Tell the women of the world that they can't go get a job involved in politics because their own man's elected. That's going to go over like a fart in church, Kevin. I mean, it's...
I'm not suggesting that.
I would. I would.
No, wait a minute. Let me finish. I'm not suggesting that because, you know, a lot of the reasons that people get connected, in, you know, whether it's marriages or so on, is related to their professions. So you can play chicken and egg on this. Which came first, the marriage or the professional entanglement? But one way or another, it's there. But we can shine the light of day on it. I am very fond of sunshine when it comes to that kind of stuff, and it has to be made clear. And I am even, you know,
it also has to be impartial.
In Congress, if you propose a bill, or if you're even going to vote on a bill, I think your shared interest needs to be under the microscope as well. So I'm all in favor of that. I don't think you can necessarily. I can't tell Wendy Graham she can't be in this business. I can tell her husband that he can't vote on things that are going to affect his wife's business.
No, we just saw an example of that with North Carolina. Phil Graham can walk out of the room. He can't disappear from people's minds. Everybody knows where he wants you to vote. Right?
Okay. Yeah, well, yeah, and... You know, we'll see how that goes. We're veering off course, though.
Well, it's the same thing. How do you enforce it?
We're going back to dealing with these agencies that are set up to do this. And so, if we say we're going to stop doing, and here's your list of things that we're going to stop doing, that saves money. That means that's money that's allocated now that you're not spending. Then what do you do next? Now here's where you get Congress involved. Now you go back to Congress for your next round of appropriations, and you say, we have a surplus last year, so we're lowering the amount of our appropriations request, and here's the things that we're going to continue to stop doing, and here's some additional things we're going to stop doing. And in an honest world, which we're not in, but if you really wanted to cut and you really wanted to involve Congress, then that's the way you have to do it. Bureaucracies tend to expand as much as they possibly can. They're
sure they do.
Little kingdoms, they're all of that kind of shit. But if you want to make it go away, that's how you do it. And if you can get a vote that says we're going to have Congress vote on whether to get rid of the Department of Education, fine, do that.
At the very least,
start saying we're going to stop doing this stuff. And USAID is going to have a surplus, doesn't need as much money next year. And before we even spend the surplus, here's our...
I think what you need to do is you have to go back to Congress and say, is this what you intended? Because if the answer is yes, it's their call, not yours.
Well, the legislative intent is right there in the bill, and it's in the discussion.
Well, so the gorilla in the room here in this discussion that we're not touching on is... Who these people are is nothing other than a duplication. Every year, I haven't done it in a while, there's a report that comes out of someplace, Office of Management and Budget or somewhere, of an estimation of where all the fraud is in Medicare and other places. You have people You could, if you wanted to, just pick that up and like read it, which of course nobody does, right?
Yeah.
The idea that you're bringing
the medical stuff is a totally separate topic.
No, but I'm saying it also does other stuff.
Seriously, needs to be addressed because that's where the big money is. But in the meantime, though, when we are looking at the how these various agencies operate and the things that they do and the things that have been uncovered and they are documented, they have the receipts on it. That we're talking about 80% type of issues.
This is the gorilla in the room, Kevin. We're dancing around it. I don't believe this. Bringing in your own team of, I'll call them auditors. I'll be nice. To go through and pick out little stuff to lob out to their constituency. Look at the crap we're spending money on. Who are these people? They're a duplication by definition because we have people in the government that this is their job. They're not doing it. I have a feeling you could probably go to the Office of Management and Budget and say, "Give me your list of the top 50 most egregious thing," and they'll rattle them off to you. But nobody ever asks the guy. Nobody ever reads it. But now because Trump's boys are involved, all of a sudden everything is all of a sudden legit, and I'm going to believe these guys?
I think you're misstating the case there. I think everybody brings in their own people to look at...
No, you don't.
Yes, you
don't.
You
don't bring in your own... Who are these people? They're not auditors? They're not the opposite?
Do we not have political appointees in the White House every presidency?
They are taking over what really already is a governmental... It's like bringing in your own... I'm not using the CIA.
Have you listened to an interview with any of the...
I don't care how smart they are. I wonder who the hell they are. Why can't we use...
Answer the question. Have you listened
I don't intend to.
With any of the cabinet members?
No, I don't want...
About what they are doing with Doge. And some, like Patel, Cash Patel, has said... No, I don't want him at this point. I'm taking my own initiatives. And others, like at Transportation, have said, "Yep, we're working real closely with him. We want him here."
What I'm talking about, Kevin, is I'm into procedure because procedure is what sets us apart, in my opinion, from like a lot of the rest of the animals of the world. If I'm the first person in there before I did this, I might just pick up a copy of Simpson Bowles and be the first person in Washington that ever read it. We've done a lot of this stuff.
Unfortunately, Simpson Bowles is in many ways not relevant because of the way things have changed since the Obama administration round one, and two because it's not enough anymore.
How does anybody know? Has anybody ever read it?
Yeah, cool. A long time ago. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is. The idea that I think this needs to be done, and maybe they're going to get to the right place, but I don't think it's bipartisan at all, and I think it's we don't.
Why do you say that?
Because they're Trump's guys. Why would it be partisan? When has ever been anything bipartisan in the guys ever? I mean, you whatever. It's not my style. Just leave it at that.
It's only one sided in that. that the Biden administration ran the government for the last 4 years, and therefore you're going to find that a whole lot of these initiatives, the things that I'm calling stupid stuff, are the same things that they ran on during the campaign that first Biden and then Harris did, and that continue to show up in a lot of the votes in Congress. And I would imagine that if we just said status quo, but we're going to have a different set of appointees in there, we're going to have all Trump appointees in there, and we're just going to operate the same way we always have, then you would find that in 4 years we would have a whole different set of stupid stuff that benefits.
But this is stupid stuff.
Right now, the other side hasn't been in control of it. The Biden administration has been in control of it. And they went all in. They went all in on trans agenda. They went all in on having DOE interpret Title IX to force people to accept men and women's sports. They went all in on a number of other initiatives, just like if you were to go back to the Obama administration, they went all in on Common Core, which...
You realize that Trump hired more people in 4 years, like three times as many.
I know.
Than Obama did in eight.
And status quo, we wouldn't like the result, or, you know, the left wouldn't like the result any more than the right likes the status quo of the way the way it's been up till now, when run by the left. So I'm not telling you that this is a left-right issue. I'm telling you that we have a government that's out of control. Spending is ridiculous. We can't afford this. We're due to crash on it, and I think there needs to be a real sense of
urgency. We're not anywhere near going to crash because of the money they're saving there.
You're interrupting me. The easiest way to do it is to evaluate what you're doing and say, stop doing that, stop doing that, stop doing that, keep doing that, that's pretty good, stop doing that, and just put the brakes on the money going out. Even if it's appropriated, you don't have to spend it.
Well, then I don't think we even need a Congress with Trump's guys, do you?
Yes.
Why?
For what I just told you. You can stop spending. That's fine. You can cut, just because the money is appropriated doesn't mean you have to spend it. And then you go back to Congress for the annual appropriations and you have them vote on a lower amount.
Except we just did that last week.
If you want to eliminate a department that was created by Congress, you have to go back to Congress and say, we're now going to vote to terminate this department. That's how it works.
I don't think that's the way it's working at all. But anyway, we'll see where it's also not anywhere near where the money is, Kevin. The money's in the drugs and the other stuff, and the money's going out to people.
I agree that the big attack is health care. But you know what? If we could take out a half a trillion, would you take it?
We're not going to be anywhere near a half a trillion.
What makes you say that?
In firing people in departments in Washington?
It's not about firing people. It's look, Tom. If you have 1,000 programs and 200 of them are worthwhile, 500 are worthwhile. It doesn't matter. Pick a number, and so you continue those and you stop doing the others. Do you need the people who administer those programs that you discontinue?
What are the 50,000 people that Trump hired? What do they do?
Do you need the people who are administering?
Kevin, you're going down this road where if Elon Musk says we don't want to do stuff for transgender stuff, which, by the way, I agree with him on that, we'll just fire those people. Okay, well, that's fine, I guess.
Do you think that Elon Musk just does that independently without Trump involved?
Oh, no, I'm sure. Well, I'm no fan of that guy. So
remember you said Trump's going to be a dictator, and a dictator would never give up that kind of power.
Okay. So, but I'm saying we don't like this program. We're going to toss it. Well, maybe nobody wants the program. It could very well be. Like I said, I don't. I have a real problem with the Department of Labor getting all over people's IRA rules. That's what the SEC is supposed to do. So I don't have a real problem. I'd say to the people at the Department of Labor, if that's what you want to do, go to work for the SEC, but get the hell out of here. I'm with you, and some of it. But what I'm saying is this: when at the end of the day, you know, the estimation and fraud in government for like a long time has been like 2-3%. So say it's higher now. Say it's 3. It's if we whittle it down to 2.
What if it's 20?
What?
What if it's really 20?
I'm talking about the numbers from the top. The numbers from your defense is not fraud, is it? Your Social Security stuff is not fraud, is it? I mean, Medicare, I don't think is. We find better ways, but it's not fraud.
A certain amount of it, but.
My point is if you whittle it down to 2, it's a pimple on the ass of an elephant over what's going on in the medical community. And the amount of money for prescription drugs that the government pays. And I don't see anybody. Trump didn't touch it his first time. Now he's 100 days into the second term. He isn't touching it now either. Now maybe he'll get to it. I hope he does.
I do too. Because I'll be, you know, I will consider the administration a failure if they don't deal with it.
I don't, but I haven't heard of any sort of. He's only got 4 years. Well, now he's got 3 years minus 100 days.
He really has 2.
Okay, but yeah, I really hope, as much as I'm not a fan, I hope he doesn't.
Very tangible results.
I hope he doesn't screw up so bad that he loses both Congresses.
Otherwise, he's shut down.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I honestly don't want that to happen, Kevin, because then all of a sudden we got another 2 years of limbo, which we can't deal with, I don't think. Anybody know what limbo means anymore?
Well, it means one of two things, and one that I can't do because I'd hurt my back, and the other one, the holding tank for people who people who neither deserve hell nor deserve heaven.
We have a listener from Arizona writes me once in a while, and she goes, she lives in this kind of retirement community. You know what they refer to it as? Heaven's waiting room.
Heaven's waiting room. I like it.
Hey,
they should put up, you know, like the entrance on one side and on the other side a mock-up of the pearly gates.
Oh, I know. Just as you know, as much as you know, we'll discuss the what's going on currently. I mean, actually, a big chunk of my issue with it, Kevin, is it's time spent not on what I think is the most important stuff. But if we go the other direction, if we try and do something on the medical side, we're talking about antitrust, which the last time I checked, if you're successful, is about a 10-year program to get rid of it, or a pretty serious change in the patent laws, or some sort of a rider on a patent law that says just because you have the patent doesn't mean you can charge anything, or anything you feel like. I don't even know the time frame and who would even write that to go through Congress. It appears to me to be, if you're fast, a minimum of a 2-year project. And if you don't get started, what is it? The journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step, right? I don't know that that's even getting started, do you? And I don't even know which one. I tell you what, if you gave me the keys to the Oval Office, I don't know which one I'd start with first either. So I'd be just as clueless, really. And all right, we got to do something here. Right? Somehow or another, I mean, we've learned a, you know what, Kevin?
Now, go ahead, finish
up. I said I've learned a lot on the show with some of the guests we've had of how the machinations work in these hospitals and these research facilities, and sort of this interplay between the drug companies and the hospitals and the research and people putting money into the stuff. I don't even know, unless, you know, you and I are, you know, see the mold eating the bacteria in the petri dish that gave us penicillin. Unless you do that, I'm not so sure I even want to issue a medical patent. Do you? There's so many people involved. How do you figure out who gets it?
Yeah, I think the whole patent process is particularly problematic in the medical world. That's probably the worst place that I won't even call them unintentional consequences. That's where the consequences are the worst. They're the worst for consumers. And so if we're supposed to be running an economy that's good for consumers and fair for consumers, then that needs to be changed. What I will tell you, I think I sent you something about this. In Canada, they actually go 20 years on the patent, and they'll give you some relief if it takes them a long time to approve the patent. But what they also do is they have price controls on all the medical stuff, which is why a lot of U.S. people, which is why a whole lot of U.S. people buy order from Canada, which is technically illegal, but nobody ever does anything about it. That's their approach. They're saying if you want the largesse, the government largesse of patent protection, then you also are going to serve a government goal that says we are not going to gouge our people on medication. So the same thing, something that you might get for $30 per pill in the U.S., instead you're paying $30 for a 90-day prescription in Canada.
Well, I had a gentleman who listens to the show corralled me in the local watering hole a while ago, and he wrote some numbers down, which is nice because I like to see numbers. And I think if you don't, it's hard to even understand the how far this can go, Kevin. I mean, the dude, first he says to me, you know, my last two Social Security increases, I think he's getting like $2,100 a month or something, or $2,200, I don't know. The last two increases of the Social Security were X, and yet, for those that don't know, because you're not 65, someday you'll get there, when you get to be 65, you're covered by Medicare, but only the hospital part. Part B is the doctor part, and you have to pay for that, which I don't know, but I think it's like $250 a month or something. Well, that comes out of your Social Security. So if you're getting $2,200, they're not going to send you to $2,200 and send you a bill. Maybe it's because they think you're too old and whatever. But they don't, to get all those checks back, nobody wants to talk about. They don't want that bureaucracy.
Nobody wants to process it.
Yeah. So they just take it out of your Social Security. So now, if you go get a supplemental plan, which most people want to and do, that pays all the stuff that Social Security or Medicare doesn't, it's probably in the neighborhood of $250 a month. All right. So, and then if you go get Part D, which is the prescription part, that's another $75 a month. So, but I mean, the last 2 years, when we're supposed to be listening, I mean, when I rag about these inflation numbers all the time, and I have reason to rag about them. Because the guy says, what, 2 years ago the Social Security raise was 4 or 5%, and this last year I think it was 2.5 or 3, something like that. Well, in both years, the medical piece went up more than the Social Security piece. So essentially they're saying, inflation for you is 2%, but for everybody else it's like 5. So you send this letter out to these old people, and you go, well, you know, I mean, 65 is not that old. But I mean, you send this letter out, and you go, hey, look, essentially in the same letter, hey, you dummy, inflation for you is 2.5%, but oh, by the way, the good stuff you pay us, we're goosing at 5. Well, how the hell do you even write that letter, first of all, Kevin? But they do. So all of a sudden now, okay, so let's say $2,200 a month times 12 is what? $24,000 plus another $3,600?
Let's say another $4,500.
All right, so you're talking $25,000, roughly. Now, if you're on, there's all these pills that cost money. If you're on, say, Eliquis or Xarelto, because I happen to be on that, his out of pocket last year with Part D, because you pay the first deductible, then they pay for a while, and then there's the, what's the hole in the middle, Kevin? He was telling me about that. I had no idea what he was talking about. There's a spot in there where there's like a hole, and then they pick up again. But the bottom line is, his cost for the one drug, Eliquis, was like $7,200, and he paid, say, $3,500. So, okay, so now the guy who's making 24 on Social Security, the first $3,500 comes off. Well, he's paying another $300 a month for the other insurances. So that's, what's that? That's $3,600, right? So he's $22,000 minus now $3,600. And now another $3,500 for one drug. So he's down to $15,000, Kevin. How the bleep do you live on that? I mean, not that Social Security is designed to be paying everything, but what if he's got like another drug in there or another drug? Then what? If he's not a veteran, and again, if it's something that keeps you alive and healthy, and my poor friend Kevin has to go down to the Amazon and wrestle the molars out of a piranha fish to get it, and it costs that much, you know what, Kevin? I don't have a problem with it. It's your decision. But if it turns out it costs $18 a year to make, I got a problem with it. I really do.
What would be a scenario with regarding patents that would make sense to you?
I think first of all, part A is you got to figure out who actually gets the patent. But let's leave that aside for a moment. I think if there needs to be some idea of what the cost going forward is, and if you give somebody. Maybe you give somebody a license agreement and say, okay, for the next, for the next 15 years, you get a buck a pill or something, or a buck and a half. You don't get to charge 50 for it, or 40, or what they used to charge for Viagra, 55?
Yeah, that's interesting, Tom. I think that's an interesting approach to it.
But it's also somewhere along the line.
Licensing fee, but it doesn't get you the unlimited ability to price gouge.
But also, I think there is some limit.
Yeah. What I was thinking is that you have a limited amount of time, a much more limited amount of time from when you go to market.
Well, that'd be Part B. I mean,
something like that. You can go to market, and you damn well better go out and establish your market share, because your patent protection is going to expire quickly enough. So, if you really want to build market share, then you cannot. You can't run the prices as high as you have been running them anyway.
But now, what's the fallback? And what's the screw up on that plan? I mean, every plan is going to be a screw up. Mine is a screw up too. But what's the screw up on that plan? What if Kevin and Chief invent the polio vaccine? Now, you're a couple years younger than me, but I think you probably, I know that when I was real young, my grandmother used to tell me my parents wouldn't even really take me to the beach. I'm talking about, you know, when I was 2 and 3, because people were still worried about polio. And I would say that, you know, my dad was a policeman. My mother worked in a bank. I don't think they made much dough. I think he made like $2,500 a year or something. I would have said that they would have given up, if forced to, they would probably have given up 2 years' pay to get me vaccinated. Polio was that big of a fear back then. When you talk about your kid possibly living in an iron lung the whole life and things like that, look at what happened to Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, they would have given any part of that up. So if somebody comes up with a vaccine that everybody wants to take in 1 year, limiting the time from 17 years down to 5 years doesn't get you anywhere, does it? It still comes down to how much does the damn thing cost? And you can double it, you can triple it, but you can't be 1,000 over. I mean, somewhere...
It does. What I'm suggesting to you, though, is that let's take the 17-year patent protection mode. If you really want your brand name to be the brand name, you want Viagra to be the brand name, not generics or anything like that, then somewhere in there, after you've gouged long enough, somewhere in there, as it's starting to wind down, you better start getting your prices down, because you know competition is coming, and you want to somehow preempt that. Now, if you have the drug where you have to go wrestle alligators in the Amazon, I don't think you're going to find a lot of companies who are jumping on board and saying, okay, I'll make the generic for that one. I'll send my own people down to wrestle alligators in the Amazon. That's not going to happen. So that's sort of that extreme case. But what I'm suggesting is, let's just say your patent protection is 3 years or 4 years, whatever the number is, that if the competition is coming soon, it behooves you not just to make as much money as you can, as quickly as you can, but there's another aspect of it, because market share is more determinant of long-term profitability than this year's profitability is. It's a different game when you are up against competition. And so if we give somebody the protection to roll something out to the market and reap the benefits of their R&D, they can't do it for very long if the clock's ticking and they're going to have competition pretty damn soon.
If we have a couple of minutes, Kevin, and Russell, I think he's on, I hope he is. I actually was cleaning my place up. I dug out a paper that I wrote in grad school on this very topic. A little bit, then I tossed it out, right? But I still remember, if there's no patents in a regular world, and Russell, get out your thing, tell me if we get an ABC on this.
I don't want Russell to get out his thing. I don't want to know.
Oh, no, his red pencil.
Oh, okay.
In a real world, if the three of us invent the hula hoop, right, and all of a sudden the thing is a big winner, and it costs us $1 to make the damn thing. Okay? Now we're first on the market. If we decide to charge 10 and hope that, we've hit somebody who's pretty smart making the damn thing, and we have a process that's pretty hard to duplicate. So we decide to charge 10 and we're making hand over fist. I mean, now today, $9 isn't all that much, but when I wrote the paper, we have a choice. We can either try and gouge the damn place for 10, hope it's a fly-by-night thing, everybody buys one and nobody cares about it afterward. Or if it's a product going forward, we might decide, you know what, we really could charge 3, which would cover distribution, cover everything, and make a return way better than risk-free, say. And we're going to make a really solid return. When everybody else is making 10% a year, we're going to be making 30. Now, if we charge 3, look at our competitors. The competitors might go, well, these three knuckleheads got themselves a deal here, but I don't really feel like building a plant just to charge $250, because then he can just charge $250 because he's ahead of us, and I'm not going to get anywhere. But now if he's charging $10, now I got some room. So what you do is you try and price yourself. Because you're first, there's an advantage to it, and it's up to you to decide how big of an advantage. And if you take advantage a little bit and don't get greedy, you don't decide that the guy next door goes, holy bleep, Batman, look at how much he's making on this. I can't wait to get into that business. There's room in there for you to get, I think I used the term was, I forget what the term was. It was return to invention. It was return to invention. If you price it right, you can maintain that return to invention for quite a while if you don't get greedy. And that's why people always are going to invent stuff. So even if it's another, if you got rid of all the patent laws, all the dire stuff that nobody's ever going to do any research for, is all bull bleep. People will, because there's still that return for being first, I think. Russell, you think I've got it? I'm onto something here or no?
You're onto something, but you're coming up from a different angle than I talk about it from. And what I talk about it from is one of the Warren Buffett tenets, which is having a moat around your business. And part of the competitive moat is, you know, the name brand thing like Coca-Cola, but also being the low-cost producer. So nobody's going to come in and take any market share from you, because they're not going to be able to compete on brand name, which you guys already talked about, but they're not going to be able to compete on price either. And as long as you...
What Russ was saying, and what I was going to jump on to, is and it's what you were describing, Tom, is that you're talking about the experience curve that comes with being first to market, and your ability not just to be out there by yourself for a while, but also to be fine-tuning your production process and your distribution process so that your cost structure is really, really good. So anybody else who comes in, whatever return you get, let's say you're getting, 18% return on equity out of your process, somebody else comes in and they can price it exact same as you, but because they don't have the experience producing it, their cost structure is going to yield 12% or something like that. And that's going to put them in a tough position. Now, can they catch up? Yeah, because there becomes, typically there is some finite amount that you can squeeze out of your process. But nevertheless, that's where first to market is a big advantage. Unfortunately, a lot of companies are first to market with really good ideas and really good products, but they don't handle the cost side as Russell described. And therefore, they piss away their advantage.
By the way, since Russell brought it up, to you gentlemen, because you might, I just had this thing in the stupid stuff I read from this Quora. Do you know the person who essentially, I won't say invented, but made Coca-Cola what it is today? What process did that? Was Coca-Cola, the syrup was originally, a drug, wasn't it? It had cocaine in it and stuff?
Yes, it did.
And you mixed it with water, I believe. And somebody somewhere decided to mix it with sparkling water, and all of a sudden everybody goes, hey, this is pretty damn good. And then it became Coke. But until then, people didn't use sparkling water. They used regular water, and I guess it sucked. I'd never known that until I read this.
Oh, yeah. No, I lived in Atlanta for 5 years. I knew everything there is to know about Coke.
Is that what happened? As soon as somebody decided to use sparkling water, it took off?
I think the flavor part is what got it going. Yeah.
What was it originally for? Was it for drinking? Was it some kind of an elixir? Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. They'd serve it at the drugstore, at the counter at the drugstore. That.
Well, you know who made his first fortune at stuff they sold at the drugstore was Arm & Hammer. During the Prohibition, he made something called tincture of ginger, which was some kind of an elixir that was mostly alcohol, was sold through drugstores. Mm-hmm. And at the drugstore soda fountain, if anybody remembers those, you mixed it with ginger ale and you had a highball.
Alright, well, on that note, I'm...
hey, Kevin, you gotta answer one question before you go. Two guys asked me last night, tell your genius friend, play-in games, do they get half of a share?
Well, that's what I was trying to find out last night, and I haven't been able to hunt it down anywhere. Because I'm assuming they get some kind of a share, and if you're a 16 seed, I would think at that point you would probably want a play-in game, because you're going to lose. A pair of 16 seeds playing like Alabama State and St. Francis last night, well, one of them's going to lose anyway. But if you go right into your 16 versus 1, you're virtually guaranteed to lose. So you might as well get the second game, you know, a chance at a second game by playing another 16, see if you can win that play, that, you know, first four game, and then go get another payment. So I don't know, but it sounds to me like getting the play-in game for, you know, North Carolina or San Diego State, not a good deal necessarily, because they're, you know, especially a major conference school. I'm trying to think of who's, I think there's like Alabama is playing tonight. Well, Alabama, you know, the SEC is getting a crap ton of money out of this tournament anyway. That's not going to make that much difference. But for a 16 and a small conference that the 16s usually represent, getting a second game is a big deal.
Well, so I'm saying
I don't know what the share is. I'd love to know what the share is for that. I can't believe that they're getting nothing. So,
well, the game tomorrow will be, they'll get a full share of a game, right?
Yes.
The conference will, or somebody. Yeah. Who's the somebody, a 16 just won a couple of years ago. I forget, why am I going so feeble?
I think Virginia lost to a 16.
Because up until then, a 16 had...
Then came back the next year and won the championship.
But the up until then, a 1 had never lost, but several 2s have lost, right?
Yeah. Several is probably a little bit of an overstatement, but a few number 2s have lost.
Okay, then. So, Russell, what do you think of your new coach?
My new coach? I don't know a whole lot about him. It's kind of... It's really funny. Having been on the other side of this so many times at Memphis State, University of Memphis, where everybody just knows the coach is already got a new deal somewhere else. You know, I was talking to an Indiana guy on Monday, and I said, they know who the coach is going to be. But my assumption was it was somebody coaching a tournament team. And as soon as they lost in the tournament, they'd name the new coach. And since West Virginia got screwed out of being in the tournament, because you get more NIL number money out of North Carolina or something like that, or whatever. But North Carolina got favored over got either West Virginia or Indiana spot, which I think is kind of funny. But you know, as soon as it became apparent West Virginia wasn't going to play anymore, we named our new coach.
Well, did the Indiana guy get pilfered? He quit, or did they fire him?
I think it was kind of a mutual, this isn't working out.
Yeah, they fired him in season.
I really feel like
that. In season.
Yeah. I mean,
Darian DeVries is the new coach. He was very successful at Drake. I know Notre Dame looked at him when they hired Shrewsbury. He also, his son was the player of the year in the Missouri Valley, so his son went with him, and I don't know if his son still has eligibility, if he'll go to Indiana with him. But DeVries, a year later, took the job at West Virginia, stayed there 1 year, and now he's at Indiana, which, you know, I consider that a little suspect in that I don't know how you hold players, you know, suggest to players that they should stick around when the coach nomads every year. But that's another issue. But he is a very good coach. I know the people at Drake really liked him a lot and thought very highly of him as a coach. So that's the extent of what I know. Now I'm really going to go away.
All right. I'll ask Russell then the next question. When you hang for a sec, Kevin, it seems to me that there's almost two jobs now of a coach. I don't know that the coach, let's put it this way, can do. One is coaching your players and all the other stuff that goes on with basketball, practices, all those kinds of things. The other is managing this NIL and stuff, and I'm not so sure the skill set's the same.
It's not, and you know what some of these programs have already done is they've named general managers.
I got to believe it's somebody.
And I'll tell you, if I... And that's something that, not in name, but that's something we got at Memphis. We got a new athletic director about this time last year. And one of the things that he did was he went to Anthony Hardaway and he said, you know, how can we support you with all the outside of coaching stuff that goes with coaching? And I think that's made a difference in this season. But that's what, if I were, you know, not that I'm ever going to be in one of these places, but if you're, I feel like when you negotiate a job like working at Indiana, there are a lot of extra things that you negotiate, your assistant salaries, et cetera. But I would really want some strong administrative support to make sure all of that other stuff is being run and I'm not worried about who's running it and how it's being run.
But it goes beyond,
because that's where the mistakes come from. And that's, you know, we talked about, you know, the coaches being responsible for how the student athlete behaves 12 months out of the year, and they're not even allowed to have contact with them 12 months out of the year.
Well, yeah.
You know, how do you handle stuff like that? That's something you've brought up multiple times. And having somebody that is able to deal with all of that in one capacity or another, I think I don't think you can be successful in this day and age unless you have that kind of support.
Well, even with,
you know, much like you can't have a decent, you really can't do well in Major League Baseball unless you have a really good GM.
Well, when you say a GM, I guess where I'm getting to is that, you know, I've said this more about football, but basketball is sort of the same thing. When you go out and recruit people, you know, you have your network, I guess, of high school coaches and people, and then people send you films and all this kind of crap. And I guess maybe you'll go out and see somebody play, but generally, I guess it's through films. And you have you narrow your people down to what you're looking for. And, you know, it's a big job and it's a lot of money. But now, let's say you got a basketball team, Indiana, Notre Dame, Memphis, whoever the hell it is, and you've got, you know, 500 people in the portal, or 400 or 300.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't see how the current coach and assistants, the person who's managing that, it has to be almost as skilled on basketball talent as the coach, because he can't be bringing in guys the coach doesn't want. But somebody has to sit there and go, gee, here's Kevin O'Neill. He's playing for St. God knows where, Slippery Rock. He's in the portal. Who the hell is he? Now, I guess you go back to his high school stats somewhere, and maybe you've got some high school films on him if you recruited him, which, as Kevin's always talking, it's a lot of times these are people that you recruited anyway, so you know all about him. But what if it isn't? I mean, is the school free with the films? I don't know. If the school's been on ESPN 5 times, can you get the game film from ESPN if you're a major college? Maybe, probably, I don't know. So you sit there and watch the guy in the game. I mean, how many hours?
I know what you do. Have you ever been to a Final Four?
No, but one of these days, maybe. Actually, I have no desire in those big stadiums.
Yeah, the game's kind of irritating.
I'd rather go to the week before, actually. But
I stayed at the coach's hotel when I went to a Final Four. And those guys are planted in the lobby 24/7, and all they're doing is running their mouths. It's basically they're all trying to network for the next assistant jobs, etc. Oh, yeah. There's always a specific. I had a really good friend who's not with us anymore that was her thing. She would go to the Final Four with one of her friends every year, and there was like a whole, I don't know, contingent of people that would know everything that was going on. And she kind of explained to me, oh yeah, you're at the coach's hotel, and that's where they're all networking for jobs. But I assume that there's you know, networking over who's in the portal and what you're looking for and those sorts of things as well.
But I mean, I don't know how Jerry Krause heard about him.
Pippen?
Yeah. I mean, so I'm saying, what if you in the portal? Here comes Scottie Pippen from St. Augustine, whatever the place is down here, the Division II school. The guy could be, you know, a diamond in the rough. He could be a schmuck. But if there's 500 of those guys in the portal, what kind of staff do you need to evaluate? I mean, how do you get the stuff?
You have to have a previous relationship there.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But you don't find a diamond that way. I mean,
No, you don't. I don't know. Do we need to? You know, this is, and I've actually I had this thought recently with respect to what if somebody could come up with a really good sabermetrics type thing for college basketball? since they all can move around, and there's a quant way to figure that one out.
I bet there is.
Yeah, you think IU would put me on the basketball staff?
But I mean, if the Notre Dame or Indiana second string quarterback says I'm out of here, I should be starting. We know the kid was pretty good in high school. Now he's a junior. I don't think Indiana or Notre Dame is going to send you practice tapes to help the kid leave.
I honestly think the first screen is your physical attributes.
But I mean, you're not going to go.
If you're second string at Indiana and you had a great high school career, but you're 5'11".
Oh yeah.
I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if you're not going to get a lot of. You're instantly not going to get looks.
Well, I guess what I'm clumsily trying to say here is, coming out of high school, the coach has. Plus, he probably likes you. It has every reason to promote your career with films and with whatever you need to know as a college scout or college recruiter scout. I've got to believe the portal is a lot more difficult to get that information. Plus, people are demanding money. So,
I think that's what the GMs are for.
But I mean, how
more
do you?
More than anything else, is coordinating all of that stuff.
Well, okay, it's one thing to say. The second-string quarterback who used to be good in high school from Indiana or Notre Dame looks like he wants to leave. And by the way, we only got like one guy. We'll take a chance on him and give him a scholarship. That's point one. Hey, but wait a minute. The dude wants $250,000 a year. How do you decide that when you got no films and he's never played?
You got to roll the dice.
Yeah, I guess.
And hey, so you got to put. And then, you know, how many times are you going to get a donor to pony up for the next big thing when they're not the next big thing? Because you've got to, not only do you, you know, it's like a Hunger Games situation here. Not only do you need to convince somebody to come play at your school, but you got to convince your supporters to pay this person. And to pay this person enough to get them to come here, and if you recruit, you know, if you go into the portal and you grab what's supposed to be a great quarterback three times, and all three times they bust out for various reasons, you know, how easy is it going to be to dip your hand into the well for the fourth time?
Well, it depends on.
It's not. I feel like there's going to be an exhaustion with respect to the amount of money that the colleges can tap to. Bring in the talent.
Oh, I think that those places are going to end up being profit centers, Russell. There's no way you can. But I mean,
they have to be.
But I mean,
the conference that Memphis is in has mandated that a certain dollar amount be paid out to college athletes
from the school.
It's going to be each school to be a member of the conference. You have to be returning $10 million in benefits to college athletes. Period.
Well, I mean, that's the school's been able to pay a stipend for a while, and the amount was determined on the. But I'm saying
that's been determined by the conferences as well.
We've identified you being part of this. What, four or five levels of NIL that we've uncovered? One of them is the pool for the offensive lineman. Okay, so if you bring in a lineman, and everybody on the offensive line is getting $50,000, and you got a spot, I don't think anybody's going to bitch. If little Russell gets the $50,000, but it's quite another if you go to Nike or Under Armour and say this quarterback's going to be our salvation, you got to sponsor him for $1 million a year, and then the guy doesn't play. That's what you're talking about. I'm saying on my level, just bringing him in as a lineman, and all the linemen are getting $50,000. I don't think anybody cares on that one so much. But I think on the I mean, if Under Armour would have given, what was the guy 2 years ago, Notre Dame, Harden, whatever his name was, if he all of a sudden never saw the field, I bet Under Armour has a problem with that, wouldn't you?
Oh, I'm sure they'd have a problem with that. Yeah, what's funny is I think one of the highest NIL folks out there is the Manning kid, who's really not played that much at Texas. Think about that from just a competition standpoint, that you've got a university that can probably, you know, he may be, I think Deion Sanders' kid was the highest NIL guy last year, and there's no really good statistics on, or, you know, like good database on the NIL money, which I think.
We missed, but, you missed a couple.
No, I know. I skipped out on you there for a second. But think about that. Texas, they've got enough money to pay the backup the last 2 years more than just about any other university starter got paid.
Okay, but now I keep asking questions.
How many schools are going to have an unlimited amount of money like that?
The Manning kid, again, with the four or five different areas that we've uncovered, is the money he's making NIL stuff that Texas arranged for him, or is it because he's doing commercials with his uncles? He's doing commercials with his uncles. I mean, that has nothing to do with Texas.
I don't know if he's doing commercials with those guys.
Well, I'm saying
I don't even know what he looks like. You know, I would know what Peyton and Eli look like now, but
kid kind of looks just like him.
I wouldn't know what he looks like if somebody didn't say that's who he is.
He kind of looks just like him. Duh.
Does he?
Yeah, but not, you know, you can see the resemblance. If you saw him, you wouldn't probably say that's a Manning, but if you saw him next to each other, you'd say there's a resemblance. Let's put it that way.
Gotcha.
But I mean, gotcha. I mean, I don't know. You know, the girl at Notre Dame, Hannah Hidalgo, just got the big thing with Red Bull. Mm-hmm. Notre Dame didn't give her that. I mean, you know, maybe there's something there, but she's very attractive.
I would assume that, you know, that Red Bull is also sponsoring some Notre Dame stuff.
Probably.
Well.
I mean, I'm sure there's they know each other. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there would be a difference if you're the benefactor to Texas. And they asked you to give the kid $1 million a year, and he's not playing. That would be somewhat of an issue. But if he's making money,
and I am sure there's a booster collective that handles all of that.
But if he's getting it on his own, doing State Farm commercials because he's Jake from State Farm's kid, that's not on you. It's on State Farm. I mean,
probably. But again, State Farm has a relationship with all the they have relationship with all the universities during college football season.
Oh, I would agree.
So I think some of it gets filtered that way.
But I mean, some of these guys, you wouldn't want them anywhere close to your commercial. You don't want them being representative of your brand. You want to play football.
If I were at a car insurance company and I wanted to filter some NIL money, I would filter the NIL money, and I would say, and you can have this money as long as you never get behind the wheel.
Well, I'm just saying.
Here's an unlimited Uber card. Here's a driver. But having somebody that's about 19 with a whole lot of money and a very fast car associated with my car insurance company, probably not a good idea.
Well, you can put Caitlin Clark, who's the other one, the ladies doing the other commercials, Reese. You can put her on a commercial, and she... Mm-hmm. You know, she beams for the company. People want to be like her. Some of these football players, basketball players, I'm not so sure you want them being the face of your company.
Oh, no, they're fine, yeah.
I'm just saying. I mean, it's not a shot at anybody. It's just, you know, just the way it is. Hey, okay, we got what time is it here? We need to go to break? Yeah, we should go to break, and we'll come back. Let's talk some market. And how long is Vic's going to stay over 20 without something bad happening or something? S&P futures are up 8, NASDAQ futures up 47. Again, Fed day today. Nobody's expecting a move, but everybody's going to expect the speech. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Well, welcome back, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 9. The S&P futures up 54. We're trying to
claw back a crummy day yesterday after two good days. We had a crummy day yesterday, actually fairly crummy, as we will, well, I'll tell you just how crummy. I guess I could do that. Yesterday, the we have, you know what, I have an issue with, Russell, believe it or not. My computer is, the people from, why don't you do traffic, weather, sport, oh, there we go. Yesterday, Dow was down 260, S&P's down 60, NASDAQ down 304. So that was almost a 2% move in the NASDAQ, so that wasn't so hot. The individual stocks, we've got just about mostly all green in the Dow. We've got DAX down 154.7%, FTSE down 19.2%. CAC-RON's actually up 13.7%. Germany's defense stocks fall after lawmakers open door to higher spending. Saab down 7%. There you go. So if you're in Saab, you're not doing good. Nikkei down 93. 0.2%, Hang Seng up 30.1%, Shanghai down 3.1%. We've got bond, the 10-year unchanged at 4.28, the bund minus 0.3 to 2.79, Japan's up another 2 to 1.52, so they're kind of rarefied air for them. Oil, down 15 cents still, 66.75, mired in his mid to high 60s. Brent down 10 cents, 70.47, natural gas up a dime, 4.15, RBOB unchanged, 216. Gold, which has been on a tear, is up another 460, 3045. Silver down 27 cents, 34.54. Copper up 3 cents, over $5, 505. We've got foreign exchange. Euro at 109.09, we're kind of where it's been. The British pound, 129.72. So they're quite a bit higher than they were 3-4 weeks ago, but they've been steady for the last few days. And we have crypto up 1,600, 83,722. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:35 here in Chicago. It's March 19th. Just a little bit of sports here. Last night, the Cubs played the Dodgers over in Tokyo, and the Dodgers won 4-1. For Chicago weather, it is currently 42 degrees. It's going to change a little wildly throughout the day. We might have some snow throughout the night. We're going to have some cloudiness, some wind, and a little bit of cool showers throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 55. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 52. It's going to be a pretty boring day, at least you find sunshine boring, just sunshine, that's about it. High of 74. And finally, for Chicago traffic, that Kennedy construction is causing some pretty major delays. The outbound Kennedy from from the Jamier Interchange to O'Hare is 85 minutes. Other than that, the other major expressways are experiencing a little bit of delays in the inbound. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, the market's been sort of crazy. The interest rates have not really done very much, and we don't expect the Fed to do much today. People are still, the inflation issue is not going away, and it seems to be starting to nip at the behind of the current administration, because nobody thinks they're doing much for it. And the idea that tariffs might make prices higher, let's say that's going over like a fart in church with most of the people in the economy. Now, whether they will raise prices or not, I don't know, but if that's the prediction, most people are not for any higher prices than they are right now. Where do you put all this? I mean, the VIX is over 20. Actually, it's 21, 21.67, mm-hmm. which is, the price of insurance is very high. Yet nobody really wants to sell calls, because people still think that if Trump reverses some of this stuff, we'll shoot back up. I was very worried about that for a while. Now I'm not so worried that one conversation is going to do it.
I don't think one conversation is going to do it. It'll be one statement out of the Fed could possibly do it. But, they're not going to, they wouldn't intentionally do anything if the market's not going to take particularly well. But they may admit that we may see some economic slowing for some time because of political uncertainty or something along those lines, because that's a pretty true statement. If you say something like that, it might push out any cuts farther than I think June is what they're shooting for right now. And if that happens, we'd probably get another leg down in the stock market.
What do you make of the, since you're our foreign expert, accent expert, what is the two-step going on with the European Central Bank? They just lowered rates a little bit last week, I believe. Now Germany talking about expanding their budgets, and I think they plan on borrowing, but I don't know if they, because they can't really print it because the ECB controls that, right? Even though Germany's obviously a big part of it. What is the nature of that relationship? What actually can Germany do if they decide to expand their fiscal spending? Are they going to have to borrow or tax it, or are they going to get some help from the ECB? And if they do, how does the ECB get the help to them?
They would borrow it. That's what they have to do. They don't have that printing alternative because they don't have control over that.
But if they pop out a bunch of bonds,
or they can cut spending elsewhere.
I think
that's really what has to be the way things work over there. Is they do have to operate a bit more within a budget and be cognizant that of what they're spending.
They
have to cut it elsewhere.
What makes you think that the, and again, I'm asking you because I don't know, the German, I use the term Treasury Secretary, I refuse to believe that he does not have Christine Lagarde's phone number.
Oh, no, they all work very closely together.
And to say, look, we're going to increase our spending by 10%, mostly for defense, but some infrastructure as well. And it's going to be X numbers of dollars. Are you guys going to buy any of these bonds for us? Which essentially means, I think the answer is going to be yes. Now the question is there a hard number? Are they just going to promise some help vaguely? I can't believe that if they're going to increase their spending by $10 billion, that every single dime of it is going to be borrowed. I think they're going to get some help someplace, Russell, because I think some of the other countries are doing it too. Right?
Well, I know that the ECB has to, for the weaker countries in the Eurozone, has to kind of, I don't want to say bailout, but many support them, and that Germany's on the other side of that, where they're actually kind of supporting some of their neighbors, which makes me, wonder if when they want to do something, if they get more cooperation than some of the other countries.
Well, because just for listeners, I think everybody probably knows this, but I'll roll real quick. I mean, here, if you want to print money, essentially the Treasury is going to issue some bonds. People are going to buy them, and then the Fed is going to come in and buy some of the bonds from essentially the people who just bought them, because I don't think they can buy them directly from the Fed, although who knows if they obey that rule. So essentially, what the Fed buys is new money, correct? Mm-hmm. Over there, there isn't a German central bank, or there isn't a German Fed. The Fed is the ECB, central bank. But they could do the same thing, but it has to be some kind of a deal worked out, right? Germany's just not going to issue all this crap and just assuming they're going to show up, right? They better know beforehand.
Oh, that they're going to have decent demand for
that the ECB is going to help out the.
Yeah.
Otherwise, your interest rate is going to go to the moon, right?
Yeah. No, my assumption is that they have a pretty good idea as to what they can do within the marketplace before tipping the scales.
Yeah,
they seem to do that well here.
It's a little more complicated, I guess, is my message,
yeah.
Right?
And
because there's one. Because whatever they do for Germany, they're going to have to do for everybody else, right? Or at least,
yeah.
I mean, it's money in the system. It's a euro dollar in the system. Or a euro, not a euro dollar. A euro in the
currency.
System.
Yeah.
In the system. So the same person from Germany could take it across the street into Austria, and it still counts, right?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Now, what happens if they pour euros in? It almost, if they're going to do a lot of it, we would probably almost want to short euro and buy Swiss francs, wouldn't we? We wouldn't be the only people to think about that, but
yeah. Or I would actually take a look if I don't know the relative levels right now, but the pound has been under so much pressure for so long. You got to wonder if that might actually hold up better than the euro currency for a while, because they've been through so much of their own crap lately.
But they're compared to the dollar, they're on like a fairly recent high. The pound, they got down to they're at 129. Didn't they get down to only 126 or something?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking long term. They used to be close to 2.
Yeah, oh yeah. What's the Canadian with all this mess going on? Canadian's what, like 70 cents, 65?
I think about 75 cents.
Yeah. Are we going to go that route and have the dollars or coins and the first bills $2 or something?
Is that what they do up there? The dollars are coins, right?
Oh, they do dollars. You know, dollar coins would be really nice. I don't know why they've never caught on. Apparently, it's a much cheaper way to issue money. I'm surprised that Trump hasn't jumped on that one. I know they've talked about eliminating pennies, which has always made sense to me. But the having metal instead of paper currency does make a big difference as far as how long that stuff lasts, and the cost about having it in circulation are lower. So I'm sorry, but so there was another topic that I heard that got brought. Oh, the daylight savings time thing for Trump. Somebody asked him about it, and he said, "Well, you know, that's like an 80% issue, and where 80% of people are kind of like, yeah, we should probably just go ahead and change the daylight savings time thing." He goes, "That's not the kind of stuff we're going to try to get through here. We're going to try to get through the more important type things and ignore that." And I think the currency thing is probably one of those things that's not at the top of the list.
Well, I got a roll of dollars.
That's a first-term president thing. Come in and do a couple things that make everybody happy, or you know, shake things up that make an awful lot of sense, and then second term you do the stuff that makes people angry because they can't vote you out. You're leaving anyway.
I have a roll of silver dollars I've had for probably 10 years. I've never even opened because they were the only coin that they were going to take in the parking meters. And then now the parking is so expensive, it's like $10 to park anywhere. So what's the point? I just use it.
You don't have the roll of the. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
The silver ones, or is it the gold ones?
Yeah, well, these are the Susan B. Anthony's, aren't they?
Yeah. We've got gold dollar coins that are in circulation. They're not real gold, but they're gold colored.
Yeah, these I think these are, but I don't know. I never remember unwrapped the roll's $20. You get 20 of them.
Yeah, those. I've still got about half a roll because that's what we used for Tooth Fairy stuff.
What happened to the
dollars, man?
My first many years I used to go to Vegas. Those were all real silver dollars using the slot machine. What happened to all those? Now you go, they look like they're silver dollars, but they're not.
They retired them for the Susan B. Anthony ones, didn't they?
But I mean, they used to be able to. Matter of fact, you'd go home with like 20 of those in your pocket. You could barely keep your pants up. I mean, they were big.
They were huge.
Well, the slot machines, you actually can still get what they look like silver dollars, but they're not. They're like plugs or whatever you want to call them. But those are, can you go from casino to casino with those? I think you can. But they just work in slot machines, so you can't go into a bank and use them. I don't think. You got to turn them in for real cash. But anyway, so
I stay away from those things. So.
Well, the slot machines?
Yeah.
Well, if you knew one was going to win, you'd be the first guy there.
Of course I would be, but and I know there's a way supposedly to figure that one out. I'm okay.
Well, we won a pretty good prize down in the Bahamas. We were down there teaching. And it was I think she won like $1,500 or something. Anyway, but yeah, it was pretty cool. And so much where the machine didn't pay it out, the guy had to come out and give her the 15 hundos.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. You know, so it was kind of cool. Of course, typical Audrey, we walked right out. Most people would have, like, gone to the bar or something for a while, but you know where it was?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, just said, see it, and said, she's out of here. It was at the Atlantis. Did you ever go to that place?
Oh, really?
Yeah, did you ever go to that place?
I have stayed at the Atlantis, but I've been at the Atlantis, with a 4 and a 6-year-old.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I just remember
it wasn't Atlantis going into the casino.
I just remember the boats out in the harbor were absolutely unbelievable, weren't they?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, we saw those things tonight. We were there. We were there over the Christmas New Year's when we went with the kids.
Well,
there was a lot on the dock. Of really wealthy people.
Well, there were people walking mostly from South America. There were people walking by, and I'm looking at the watch, the shoes, and the neck chain, and I'm going, that's worth more than every piece of clothes I've ever worn in my whole life. I mean,
my house. Yeah, my first house.
The Rolex guys were there, and but this big, huge yacht, right? I'm standing on the dock, and the bow is, 3 feet over my head. The thing had to be 125 feet. We
you could rent it for a week with guys in there cooking you food and booze and all you wanted for like 8 people or 10 people for like $10,000. And I'm like,
well, Audrey, you got to go back to the slots.
Well, I'm thinking it, but guess what? If you wanted to go anywhere, it was like $35,000 to fill it up.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
So I mean, yeah, you could hang on the dock and eat and drink on the thing, but if you actually wanted to get it powered up and go for a ride,
in the fine print it says if you actually want to go out, you got to pay for the gas.
Oh god, yeah, yeah. It was like some massive amount of dough. It was like double the week's lodging. Mm-hmm. So hey, I've talked to 2 or 3 people this week, and I don't really want to get into. But the thing that's kind of weird, Russell, is, you know, I mean, I do this for people, and you are always a pretty good thing, good person to bounce stuff off of. Mm-hmm. What I just can't get over, I mean, with the COVID, you know, we didn't see people for a while. I bumped into a few people in the last couple of weeks that I really haven't seen in like 5 years. And they know I'm in the business. And, you know, I'm a money manager and I do stuff for people. And yet, they come up and, by the way, I look older, they look older, right? And they say, and we may even have talked about their portfolios 5, 6 years ago. Well, now, if they've been in the stocks and they kept their money in there the last couple of years, they now have a lot more money in their portfolio than the first time I talked to them. But the other wrinkle is, now they're not working anymore.
Okay.
And I say, okay, well, you've got this money, and you've done very, very well. The market's been up, you know, not every stock, obviously. But some of these guys were into Apple. A few were in NVIDIA. A few were one of the ones that moved. Now, a few other guys were in stuff that didn't move. And it was an awful lot of stocks that didn't go anywhere, right? And that, or there, if you're in the Qs or the Russell, you participate, not the Russell so much, but the Spider, you participated. And I say, well, you know, I'm not a market timer, never have been. Don't hold myself out to be. I said, but the market's a little high here. By the way, your situation has changed. Do you think you might want me to protect some of this? What are you talking about? Well, what do you mean, what do I talk about? You're 5 years older. You used to work, make a good salary. Now you're not. The money's, your portfolio is worth more. But by the way, that's all you got. Why don't we, you know, is there something you might want to do here? Lighten up? Some fixed income? Oh, no, I just talked to my guy yesterday. He says, stay in, always buy the dip. Yeah, but you're not 40 anymore. It's not about, I don't think anybody... I would never, if somebody was 25 years old and is putting $200 in the market and has $3,000 in there, I would never tell a guy, because the market looks a little shabby to me here, sell your Spiders. I would say just keep putting $100 a week in. You're 30 years out. But everybody's not there. They think they still are, Russell. It's weird. I mean, and what am I going to say to the guy? Hey, you're an old fart, for God's sake. What's the matter with you? I'm not going to do that. But don't you realize that things have changed here? It has nothing to do with my view of the market. You get nowhere with it, basically.
It's just, you know, how much time do you have to recover?
Yeah.
If we get a big old sell-off. So I know what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about. I did the road show for Kelly, talking about, you know, the financial markets going into this year. I think a lot of people throughout the state of Indiana heard about structured outcomes and those types of things for the first time ever. You know, because that's what I think makes sense in a year, going into a year like this, especially just coming off a couple of years where you're up 20% 2 years in a row. You know?
I don't know if it's going to happen, you know, in our lifetime, but I think hopefully it'll be a long time. There's been 2 or 3 times in my lifetime for a period of over a decade the market has not gone up. Well, you tell that to somebody and they think you got 58 heads.
And it typically follows the type of readings that we saw in the Shiller PE ratio at the end of last year.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
There have been valuation indicators that have come before that, and we just had one. So Russell, yeah, I mean, we could just mess around for the next, for the next decade.
Russell, is there any
not really getting anywhere,
since you've got your finger on the pulse of all research?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody that has as I've gotten more involved in this? You know, I went back to 2000, 2001, when everything crapped out. Not everything, the big stacks crapped out. The more telling number, I think, was not PE. It was price to revenue. Does anybody
plus sales?
Yeah.
Because I mean, because Cisco, I remember back in 2001 when it was $60-some a share and went down to six. By the way, not predicting anything's gonna happen now, but that's what happened. So a lot of stocks did. Oracle, they all lost like 80% of their. Cisco was like 11 times revenue, which is real high for a company that's not, you know, it isn't a startup. And a lot of these companies now, I think even, I did it a while ago, I'm not sure it's there, but I had like Microsoft at 11 times revenue. For a company that big, that's just a lot, isn't it? I mean, I think that is more telling to me, because PE ratio, if you're spending a lot of money on cost savings and all that kind of stuff, you could be doing really well cash wise, and your PE ratio is not so high.
You can engineer that number over a short period of time.
But I mean,
eventually but
somebody whose price to revenue ratio is 11, you're really saying, I think I want this company is going to double in revenue. I don't see how Nvidia, Microsoft, Apple. How the hell can they double in revenue? They'll be the only companies left. Maybe they will be. I don't know. But I mean, they seem too big to have that kind of evaluation to me. Now, am I just thinking small? Am I thinking like, you know, like it's 1975?
No, it's very difficult to move the needle on, you know, valuation-wise on a company that you know, it's like turning a big ship or turning a small boat. It's just, you know, the kind of momentum that you would need to double an Apple or an Nvidia or those kind of guys, it's like a multi-decade thing. It's not something that should be priced in, you know, for the short term like it is for a lot of these companies. I think the price to sales thing, you know, you were talking about where it was 25 years ago or so. We were using price to sales because none of those internet companies had earnings. That's really why we were utilizing. I've always said that if you're doing in the book that I'm slowly but surely finishing up on making the sell decision, a drop off in revenues is one of the first things that's like a red flag, because it's the thing that a lot of companies have the least amount of control over. Yeah, you can control your costs, you can control but you can advertise until you're blue in the face, but the most difficult thing is getting people to actually give you money.
Well, I think that, again, I have this friend who has been giving me all the numbers on his Social Security / pills and things like that in Medicare, and I'm kind of stunned that, you never think about this stuff, Russell. That's why I love doing the show. I learn something every day, which, you know, normally in life you don't necessarily. But he was telling me... It never crossed my mind that maybe there's a general slowdown every January or February, as everybody who's on Medicare has to pay their, and maybe on regular drug insurance, has to pay their deductible in January or February.
I can see that.
I mean, it's like, what is it, $600 a month in Medicare?
So yeah, I can totally see
so
that.
So if your first Social Security check is $2,200.
Percent of the economy that's dipping into, but I can totally see that. Now, see, right there, you have just described a situation that should be taken into account when you're doing adjusted economic numbers.
Yeah, well, I don't.
You know, that's a logical reason to adjust, you know, some of the numbers that are put out there. If there's something like that, you know, the deductibles haven't been met for the first 2-3 months of the year by people who have to cover those, and then all of a sudden their drug costs get covered for them.
Two questions. We don't have that much time. China has launched some new expansion plan of some kind to essentially prop markets up and do other stuff. How much? Two questions. Answer one. The other one is Google taking over this, what, Win? Is that a big deal? What is the Trump administration's view on that kind of stuff going to be? Do you have an idea?
That one's not. You know, it's one of the bigger buyouts they've ever done, but, you know, it's only a $30 billion buyout. We're not talking about a massive company here. So I don't think regulatory-wise it's too much of a problem, and it's just complementary to what they're doing in the cloud computing space is what I understand.
Okay, so a lot of people are thinking it's going to be a long road.
There's something technology-wise, that they've wanted out of these guys for a while, because this is their second run at this company, and they wanted to pay $23 billion like a year ago, and now they're paying $30 billion. So there's some niche technology that they've got that either spooks Google or Google thinks they really need, because that's why they buy out smaller companies.
Well, isn't it? I think it's security related, isn't it?
I believe it's cloud computing security related.
Okay, back to the China question. What can they do?
Nothing. They're doomed.
Well, they think they're not, but okay. But I'm saying, in terms of they don't necessarily control their money supply like we do, or do they try to, or what's the dynamic there?
They do everything that they can possibly do to keep their people happy.
Okay.
You know, and so that means, you know, the government, and they do everything they're going to do to keep the people happy, which creates a situation, which really creates a bad moral hazard, where people will speculate with their retirement, but they believe that the government will take care of them if they blow up their retirement. And the government doesn't have the money to do that.
Well, all the people that have mortgages in these cities you can't go in, are they still paying on that stuff, or supposedly be paying?
You would think that they would not be paying on them because the homes are not being built. I don't know. I mean, what are the repercussions if, you know, if I started making payments on a home that Mary Beth and I decided we were going to build somewhere, we stop making payments on it, they can just take that unbuilt thing away from us, and that's it. But there's no value in that unbuilt thing, and that's what the situation is over there.
Okay, so they allow
and
people...
And it gets worse, and this is the part that a lot of people don't... The part that a lot of people don't realize is the way that local government is funded in China is through land sales or land leases to new developers. So if you don't have new homes being built, they have no tax base. And with no tax base, all the services have started to fall apart. So there's so many issues over there, it's ridiculous. And the government can keep making it out. They can keep saying they're gonna do things to support the financial markets, et cetera. But, you know, I think reality will set in as the announcements don't really have any cost impact.
Okay, what's kind of a little more of a... I mean, Nancy's been talking about that. I happen to know something about this because my sister-in-law has a cousin that has a place in Florida. The two-year-ago hurricane, well, it's me, mm-hmm. Still can't get back in the building. They still made a determination whether they're going to try and fix it or just knock it down. It's like 12 stories or something on the water. Now, mm-hmm. Nancy says that she's still liable for the mortgage. Now, all these people in Pacific Palisades that are burned out,
mm-hmm.
are they still paying a mortgage? I'm sure...
They've got a mortgage. If not, then even the better part is, are they going to have to continue to pay property taxes?
Yeah, I don't...
And what's the value of the property now?
If you had to estimate, because we've had Bill Moriarty, getting him back on, my engineer buddy... Plus, I want to talk to him about his team at Marquette before they lose. He loves Marquette basketball. You know, he says a lot of times when this... Because he was in Florida putting in a water treatment plant when Homestead, that whole mess, the Category uh-huh. 5 hit Homestead. And he said the... And something you wouldn't necessarily think of, but, you know, he did. All of a sudden now, all those houses are sort of grandfathered in. And, you know, if it's up, it's up. And once it's down, and everybody gets their ass kicked by a hurricane... Generally, you have all these new building codes. So even if you do get a check from the insurance company, it's not going to cover building the place to the new codes.
Mm-hmm.
So most of those people never were able to rebuild. They're just out of there. I mean, I don't know what'll happen to them. They're probably all dead by now. But I mean, Palisades, I'm gonna say the same thing is probably going to happen.
Oh, I think it's going to be worse in California.
It'll
be a lot worse. Do you know who Adam Carolla is?
Why do I know that name? Is he a writer?
He and Jimmy Kimmel had something called The Man Show like 25, 30 years ago.
Okay.
But he's a podcaster, and he lives out in California. He's a fairly conservative guy, though. And, he wanted to expand his home, which was up on a hill. And one of the rules is if you expand, if you do any construction, all of the trees on your property have to be protected by fencing. Well, he lives on a hill, and he's got 2 acres where it's almost physically impossible to even get to the trees, let alone put a fence around them. So he couldn't do any work on his house.
Why do you want a fence around a tree? What am I missing?
To protect the tree during construction.
Ah, okay.
Because, you know, the tree feels the pain and screams when it gets cut.
I get it.
I'm being a flower child now.
Well, and, I mean,
he's been talking about that. He said it's going to be 20 years before they can get the paperwork done just to start rebuilding.
Yeah, man, let's say it's going to be a year. Well, you know, you're not far off on this. Audrey had a really nice oak tree in the front of her house on the parkway, so I guess it's technically not hers, right? Mm-hmm. And then she's also got a utility easement that runs next to her house. Well, the utility bleeps come out, and instead of hand digging, which you're supposed to around a tree, they come in with the shovel and they knock out a couple of roots. So sure enough, a couple of years later, the tree is dying. So now Orland comes out and says, we got to take the tree down. And they do. So this beautiful tree's gone. And they're going to plunk in a five-foot tall maple and say, here's your replacement. Well, duh. I mean, if Audrey had grandkids, they'll be 50 by the time the tree looks like the oak tree did. Some people do that crap all the time and don't pay any attention. You know, and then why should you lose a nice tree because these guys didn't follow what they're supposed to do? You know, just anyway. But do you think the market can stabilize? Everybody on on CNBC yesterday, of course, they should have a big thing on their head. I make my living by you giving me money and me charging you a percent, uh-huh, or a percent and a half. When they give, how come if I give investment advice, even in like a bar, I could be held liable to it, and these guys can talk their book all day long and nobody cares?
Well, what I always say is I just say I'm an academic. Sue me. Yeah. Good luck. You know.
Well, so, you're
I don't know. They have little statements that pop up just for the commercials that protect them, I think.
Well, whatever. Anyway, are you home or are you there?
I am home. It's spring break.
Aren't the play-in games down in Indianapolis?
No. No, the play-in games are in Dayton.
Oh, okay, okay.
We're Indianapolis is a regional site this year, and Indianapolis is actually where they're going to play the NIT Final Four.
Really?
Yeah, you know, it's always been a New York associated tournament, but I think they've started moving. I think they played some of them in Vegas recently as well, but or there's a different tournament like that in Vegas now. But which I was kind of disappointed that Indiana chose not to be in the NIT. I don't know if that was the alternative for them. But that would have been kind of cool because, you know, if they'd made it to the Final Four of it, they'd practically be a couple home games for them.
Well, I something to do with the coach would be my guess.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. No, I feel like when you've got a lame duck coach situation, you just pass on these things.
Yeah, it's a...
You know, and that's what it just, you know, it's time to kind of pull the plug. Financially, I don't think it makes a whole ton of sense either way. But I think everybody's ready to move on.
Well, I've been at Dayton twice, just passing through, and both times I spent a day at the Wright-Patterson Museum, and I probably have at least 2 more days to go to see the whole thing. It is one of the most spectacular things. You ever been there?
I have.
Isn't it unreal?
Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
I never made it outside after 2 days, because the first day I saw one of the movies, you know, the big circuit, what do you call those things, the sense around or something? That took an hour and a half, so I missed. But I mean, if you go and read all this stuff, you can't make it out of the first barn the first day.
Right, right. No, it's a huge huge place. I went there for kind of a work oriented thing, so I didn't get to. I spoke there.
Ah, but I mean, it's really something to go from. They have whole things like the first guy who got killed in an airplane crash, and one about the guy who flipped his goggles off and his eyes froze.
Yep.
He was so high, but then he got the plane down, and I think he got his vision back somehow. Bizarre.
Of course he did. He just scraped the ice off, and then he patented the ice scraper.
Oh, God. On that note, S&P Futures up 12. Okay, Pooch Report. How's the Art of Pooches?
Butchers are doing great. They're crawling all over me right now and driving me nuts.
Are you ever going to get the blind guy back?
The blind guy's not coming back next month. We've got a deaf one that's going to stay with us for a week. So we're figuring out games where we can sneak up on it.
You know what? Audrey's a little pooch. My little girl, Maggie, she can't hear crap, but she can still see. So all you do, you just get in front of her and you wave her your way and she comes over. They make out.
They'll figure it out.
Take care of yourself, bud. Andrew, nice job. SP Futures up 12. Hopefully we'll stay there. Fed numbers today. We'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.